Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. My pleasure to welcome you to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas for another lecture as part of Einstein Fest. And I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you to turn off your cell phones and anything else that beeps. This afternoon, our lecture focuses on exploration, and we're delighted to welcome James Delgado to Perimeter Institute. He's the Executive Director of the Vancouver Maritime Museum. When he's not at the museum, he's also the host of the National Geographic International television series, The Sea Hunters. Other television credits include specials for Discovery Channel, National Geographic Explorer, A&E, The History Channel, and ABC. James Delgado has played a major role in the study and preservation of shipwreck sites and maritime heritage. He recently led the crew that restored Ben Franklin, a 130-ton oceanographic research submersible. His undersea explorations include RMS Titanic, the recent discoveries of Carpathia, the ship that rescued Titanic's survivors, and the notorious ghost ship Mary Celeste, the polar exploration ship Maud wrecked in the Arctic, and the 1846 wreck of the United States naval brig Summers, whose tragic story inspired Herman Melville's Billy Budd. A fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and a fellow of the Explorers Club, Jim Delgado is the author and editor of nearly 30 books and numerous articles, most recently Lost Warships, An Archaeological Tour of War at Sea, and Across the Top of the World, The Quest for the Northwest Passage, both international bestsellers. We're delighted to have him with us this afternoon. Please welcome James Delgado.
Thank you. What does it take to be an explorer, and why explore? I think for Roald Amundsen, there were a variety of reasons, some very understandable to those of us today. The quest for knowledge, the opportunity to expand the frontiers of the human experience, not only in a literal way, by going to a place where few had gone before, but also an opportunity to learn while there. And as you'll see, learn he did. But also in the case of Amundsen, another quest, a quest to reach beyond the bounds of his own life, a life and the limitations that had been placed upon him, a life which continued to have limitations, not the least of which were fiscal limitations. Amundsen, like so many others before him, needed sponsorship. And in that, some of his passion and some of his quest was spurred. For Roald Amundsen, for any who would seek the Grail of his time, of his period, was that spot at the top of the world. Vaguely known, imprecisely defined, and inadequately described, the Arctic and the Arctic archipelago at the top of the world has been a siren for those who have sought it for centuries. Since the ancient texts of Pythias of Massilia talked of congealed seas where land, water, and sea and air combined together in an almost congealed mass, to later tales of Ultima Thule, this passage, this spot, was one that men fought for. The idea of a passage across the top of the world to reach the riches of Cathay was born in the aftermath of the voyages of Christopher Columbus, when in 1492 Columbus sailed across the Atlantic, encountered the Americas instead of China, and reported his discoveries back home. The idea of reaching beyond this continental landmass to find China in particular and to tap into its riches would inspire many other voyages of discovery and exploration. Most of those initial voyages were Spanish and Portuguese, and as they described and outlined the coasts of North and South America, it became readily apparent that there was no simple way to get through that landmass and into an ocean which had been discovered in the early part of the 16th century and named Pacific. To reach that spot, ultimately, geographers decided there must be some passage across the top of the world, a northwest passage, which would reach Cathay. Sir Humphrey Gilbert of England in Elizabethan times prophesied it, and his sovereign, Elizabeth, sent this man, Martin Frobisher, out to find it. Frobisher's initial voyage of 1576 started with a small group of ships. What Frobisher encountered as he sailed into the entrance of Baffin Bay was a land seemingly wild and savage and inhabited with strange creatures who existed in boats of skin and dressed in the skins of animals themselves. Initially friendly, they were driven off and actually pushed into hostility by the gunfire of the English who encountered them. Never mind, Frobisher actually found himself an interpreter by reaching over the side of his vessel, and a burly and strong sea dog was he. He literally picked this man and his kayak up and placed him on the deck of the English ship to make him his captive. From this man and from others, Frobisher learned that there were minerals on these islands, and this, unfortunately for Martin Frobisher and for his backers, would push that quest for a Northwest Passage into a different direction, the hunt for gold and riches there at the entrance of Frobisher's Straits. Frobisher would lead other expeditions to this spot, to this land. The gold that he mined, tons of it, initially proclaimed to be the source of all riches by alchemists, was ultimately found back in England to be nothing more than a mix of everyday common minerals. Tons of it were dumped on the beaches. You can still find a railway retaining wall outside London made out of Frobisher's once precious ore. After Frobisher's voyage turned bad, after his final voyage of 1578 ended in disaster, that is, financial disaster, his backers pushed away. Others followed, though, Robert Baffin, John Davis, pushing into the bounds of a large bay, which they thought might be the entrance beyond Frobisher's Straits and into this passage, but choked with ice, it proved to be impenetrable. So the quest then turned to the west again, through another entrance past Frobisher's Strait, and into a vast inland sea, a sea which promised to be the entrance to this Northwest Passage, but beginning with the voyages of Henry Hudson, ultimately was proved to be nothing more than a dead end, particularly for Hudson himself, with his son and a group of other followers marooned there in the shores of the bay, which would bear his name. For the next century after Hudson's early 17th century voyage, other mariners, Dutch, English, all pushed and prodded at the shores of Hudson's Bay, found no easy passage. Others, Samuel Hearne, Alexander Mackenzie, marched up through inland Canada to reach the shores of an icy sea, which they named Arctic. Others on the Pacific coast, James Cook in 1778, George Vancouver between 1791 and 1795, also searched that part of the continent for the exit of the Northwest Passage. Clearly, there was evidence up there in the far north of some form of passage. Imprecisely defined, this Arctic archipelago at the top of Canada would ultimately prove to be one of many Northwest Passages. But with the advent of the Napoleonic Wars, the war with the United States as it sought its independence even earlier, the War of 1812, Britain, for whom the quest had always burned as one of the brightest stars, retreated and entered decades of war. With the end of those wars, though, in 1818, with the final defeat of Napoleon, the British Navy now stood ready to go back in quest of the Northwest Passage. They expected they would find all sorts of dangers, from the ferocious polar bear depicted there to others. Little did they know that the quest for the Northwest Passage would leave an indelible stamp on the nation. In 1818, John Ross, a veteran of the War of 1812, commanded an expedition of three ships, two which would push up one side of Greenland, five ships, two pushing up one side of Greenland, another three circling through Baffin Bay. Baffin Bay, previously described by the Elizabethans, had been closed by ice for decades, but now, thanks to a trend of global warming, was opening up again. The little ice age, which had locked Europe for centuries, was over. And so now, as Ross sailed in and around and circuited that bay, he found a variety of openings which might be that passage. He caught a polar bear. He treated and talked with the local Inuit in Greenland, who were astonished to see these white men in their blue coats with their large buttons, asked them, "Who are you? Where are you from? Are you from the moon? Or are you from the stars?" Ross answered, rather, that he was from England. So Ross returns home with the spoils of his expedition. Not only has he extended geographic knowledge, he's brought back all sorts of goodies, as you can see lampooned here, for the British Museum. But unfortunately for John Ross, he also brought back the wrong answer to the Lords of the Admiralty, who had sponsored his expedition. They sought the Northwest Passage, where an entrance seemed to be in Lancaster Sound. Ross proclaimed, thanks to perhaps an optical illusion, he saw nothing but mountains, and he had the temerity to name those mountains for Croker, the second secretary of the Admiralty. Ross's lieutenants, particularly William Edward Parry, disagreed with their commander. Where Ross saw mountains, they saw an opening into the next part of the passage, and they told John Barrow, first secretary of the Admiralty, so. Barrow dismissed Ross as a fool. Ross's reputation ruined, he retired, and now Parry, in command of another expedition, pushed in right past the Croker Mountains, which were Lancaster Sound, and made his way practically through the Northwest Passage, finally stopping after winning a parliamentary prize for going further than any other man could at the top of the world. Parry wintered within a few hundred miles of the end of the Northwest Passage. The spot where he wintered in his ships, Hecla and Griper, would remain a landmark, an achievement. Today, a National Historic Site in Canada, Winter Harbor, is still marked by the rock engraved with the names of Parry, his commanders, and his ships. Parry almost made it, and indeed, had he pushed a little farther, he might have made it right into the Beaufort Sea, and then the quest for the Northwest Passage would have ended with William Edward Parry, the great hero of Arctic navigation. But the ice pushing in from the Beaufort had blocked the passage, and all Parry could do was retreat and wait for another opportunity. As Parry readied for a second opportunity, the Admiral sent Lieutenant John Franklin of the Royal Navy into Canada to trek inland, following the route previously pioneered by Samuel Hearne in the 18th century, to reach the shores of the Arctic Ocean and to begin to map the Northwest Passage. Unfortunately for Franklin, who set out with two other Royal Navy companions and a group of French-Canadian voyageurs, he was not well prepared for the expedition. He went too late, making their way through various Arctic rivers, finally reaching the shores of the ocean. They mapped, but then came home too late, their supplies running low, winter setting in. Franklin and his men were forced to retreat, starving. One of the voyageurs went mad along the way and began hunting Englishmen for food, as well as his fellow voyageurs. When one of Franklin's companions was mysteriously shot dead by the fire by this voyageur, the other English reacted by shooting him, but only the next day as they marched back, and then only in the back of the head. Franklin and the survivors huddled down in a small fort to await rescue, eating their own moccasins and half-rotten caribou that they had buried the year before. Scraping marrow out of rotten and half-burned bones, they might have died were it not for the local First Nations who rescued them. Franklin went home to fame as the man who ate his boots. He would mount a second overland expedition with far greater success in 1826-1827. But at that time, as he headed out, William Edward Parry also went out again by sea. Parry's second expedition was not as easy as his first. Winter conditions were more harsh. His ships caught in the ice had to dig their way through and wait through a long and arduous winter. Parry's journals, usually filled with writing, are very silent in this period, other than a few notations about the long, bitter, cold Arctic nights. When they finally broke out of the ice, they were only able to go a few hundred miles on, where finally, at the entrance to another strait and another sound, they stopped, only to be caught by ice. Hecla and Fury, Parry's ships, were being pushed towards the shore. HMS Fury fetched up hard against the cliffs and began to be pushed under by the ice. The men scampered off. They landed their supplies as quickly as they could. Everyone managed to get onto Hecla and then beat a hasty retreat from the Arctic. Fury, ground up by the ice, disappeared. To this day, Fury Beach in the Arctic is still littered, as you can see, with the remnants of the ship and all the stores and supplies that the men were able to land before their vessel was eaten by the far north. The Arctic, this Northwest Passage, as it now turned out, was not as easy as they thought. Indeed, Parry's first voyage that merely making it through voyage had proved to be too simple. A new type of Arctic was emerging, a terrifying, weird, and tragic land, a land where successive expeditions found the ice to be too much for them. Ships caught and twisted nearly sunk, HMS Terror, so appropriately named, caught in the ice pack on George Back's expedition of the 1830s, nearly lost in 1837. Retreating, leaking, she had to be beached on England's shores before she went down because she couldn't reach the safety of the Thames. By 1839, it was clear that there was some form of passage there. Various expeditions had pushed and prodded and had mapped certain portions of it. There was a blank spot in the middle of the map that remained unknown, a spot that Hudson's Bay Company explorers and fur traders had begun to also map, like Peter Dees and Simpson. But at this stage, there also was another near tragedy. John Ross, lampooned and mocked by the press and by his peers after his expedition had failed in 1818, returned to the Arctic on a privately sponsored expedition with the first steamer to go north, named Victory and sponsored by Felix Booth of Booth's Gin in London. Victory made her way past Fury Beach and to a spot where no one had been before. There, Ross and his men encountered the Netsilik Inuit and learned something rather important, something that Parry had learned from Ross earlier and which Parry had employed a bit, which Ross now employed even more, and that was simply sitting down and asking the people who lived there about the land in which they lived and how they survived. Ross is the first man to ever hand a piece of paper to the Inuit and ask them to draw a map. And those maps, preserved in the archives of the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge, are a marvel because they accurately depict the land as these people saw it as they walked and traversed the Northwest Passage. Indeed, it never really needed to be found. They knew it, of course, and had for hundreds of years, if not thousands, but the Inuit had no reason to trade or sail in large ships in search of the riches of Cathay or fame as international explorers. Ross's expedition also was one other different look at it all, because as they lay wintered into their harbor at Victory Point, Ross sent his nephew James Clark Ross out, and James Clark would be the first, using scientific instruments, to accurately plot the location of the magnetic North Pole on a peninsula of land named for their sponsor, Felix Booth. The Boothia Peninsula would become a landmark in scientific achievement when Ross fixed that point in 1831. But the ice, always the ice, came back. Victory could not safely be navigated out. The engines had never worked properly, and so Ross, in a fit of pique, had them dismantled and thrown onto the beach next to the ship's moorage, where they remain to this day. And finally, unable to even sail his ship out, wrapped her with chain, nailed the flag to her mast, poured a toast of gin to the sponsor, and then he and the men decided to retreat after 3 long years. Their food was running out. They were in dire straits, in fact. Scurvy had set in, scurvy so bad that Ross's wounds from the War of 1812 had reopened, and he bled from scars that had once healed. As the men marched their way down the Boothia Peninsula, they could only retreat as far as Fury Beach. There, using supplies left from the wrecked Fury, they managed to eke out a miserable existence over the next winter, building a hut out of shattered timbers, Fury's sails, and also, thankfully, finding a few of Fury's old lifeboats, which they managed to patch up and send out in hopes of reaching whalers, who they now understood had followed the Royal Navy into the Arctic and were beginning to catch whales just off the entrance to Lancaster Sound, the very entrance, by the way, where the Croker Mountains supposedly stood. In the summer of 1832, Fury's boats, Victory's, finally reached a spot and encountered the whaler Isabella of Hull. Ross knew the ship well. She had been chartered as his flagship on his first unfortunate expedition of 1818. As they rowed up, as they had chased this whaler along, they finally approached. The mate looked out over the stern. Ross looked up and shouted, "Which boat is that?" "Why, we are the whaler Hull of Isabella, commanded by the late and unfortunate Captain Ross on his first expedition." "I am that man," shouted Ross, to which said, "You cannot be. Captain Ross has been missing in the Arctic for a number of years, and he is dead." And John Ross had the satisfaction that others have had since of reporting that rumors of his demise were greatly exaggerated. Ross's experience certainly cemented home the decision by the Admiralty to abandon the quest for the Northwest Passage. Indeed, James Clark Ross, his nephew, knighted as was John, ultimately would take the ships Erebus and Terror south to Antarctica to plot the shores of that continent, leaving names on the landscape like that of the Ross Ice Shelf or Erebus Bay. But the quest would not die. There were those who still wanted it. Particularly, there was one last spot that had to be mapped. Somebody had to sail through. The prize had to be won. If not for English pride, then at least for world exploration. So in 1844, when the decision was made to go again, a variety of people put their names into the hat to be chosen as commander of the expedition. James Clark Ross might have gone, but he had returned married and had promised his father-in-law that he would not return to sea again. As well, James had developed an unfortunate habit in the north. There were others, Parry, no, too old. Finally, they selected this man, Captain Sir John Franklin, the famous explorer who had eaten his boots, who had made two overland treks in the 1820s, now 59 years of age, ancient by the standards of his time, grossly overweight, and just returned from an unfortunate posting in Tasmania as lieutenant governor, where he had been retired in disgrace for sparring with the local bureaucrats. John Franklin needed a new job. Spurred on by his ambitious wife, Jane, he asked for the job. Ross said, "Let him have it. The man will die if he does not get the job." And so John Franklin was put in charge of an expedition with two ships, 129 men. The cream of the crop, the best officers the Royal Navy had, who had previously served in other Arctic expeditions, went with Franklin, sailed into the Northwest Passage in the summer of 1845, and were never seen again. They vanished after leaving instructions with a group of whalers to have everybody write home by way of Russia in a year or so, because that's where they would be, having sailed to the Northwest Passage. By the end of 1847, there was some doubt as to whether or not they had made it or would ever make it. Some had complained that the route was too circuitous. Others had said that there was no way they could get through. And one, Hudson's Bay Company explorer, had prophesied that Franklin would become, in his words, the nucleus of an iceberg. Lady Franklin agitated the Admiralty for news of her husband and for the means to find him. James Clark Ross and John Ross also began to push. And so, in 1848, began the first of 32 separate expeditions to find Franklin. The Royal Navy convened an Arctic Council of distinguished explorers, whom you see here with the Secretaries of the Admiralty, to find Franklin. The expeditions included not only British expeditions, but an American expedition. A young French naval officer, Francois René Bellot, volunteered his services and commanded yet another for Lady Franklin. And Lady Franklin herself spent what today would be millions of dollars of her husband's money in a search for John. What these explorers found as they pushed and prodded into the Arctic archipelago was indeed that there were many ways that Franklin could have gone, and that any ship could have gone in. The Northwest Passage was a maze of islands, shoals, and ice. Ships would winter in, and there men learned very harshly how to live and how to survive in the frozen north. And they also began to understand what might have happened to Franklin and his men. Because indeed, on those long winter nights, with the freezing temperatures whistling for months on end, men could go mad. Men might run out of food. Men might freeze. Transiting those waters in the winter by sledge, particularly in the traditional British way of man-hauled sledges, weighing 1,000 pounds or more, being pulled by men on ropes, also proved to be arduous. And from time to time, others were lost or nearly lost. Robert McClure, one of those sent out to look for Franklin, was sent into the Pacific to make his way through the Bering Strait and there join up with his commander, Henry Kellett, and with their two ships search the western end of the passage for news of Franklin. Not waiting for Kellett, McClure decided to push on because his endeavor was not just to search for John, but rather to become the first to sail through the passage. He made his way up through Prince of Wales Strait, past Victoria Island, and there was stuck in the ice, as you can see with his ship Investigator, for the next few years. In this Bay of God's Mercy, as they named it, they waited. They trudged, they sledged, they did everything they could. They found no evidence of Franklin. They encountered very few people, if any. The Copper Inuit of the area were scarce at that time. And ultimately, starving, Robert McClure, standing on the deck of his ship, knew with certainty what had happened to Franklin. He had been trapped and he had died in the same way that McClure and his men were now about to die. But at the last moment, one day, staring at the rail, getting ready to abandon his ship with his men and trek south, hopefully to a safe, warmer spot, McClure looked out and saw a solitary figure struggling towards Investigator on the ice. The man was wrapped in rags and stained black from the soot of fires. As McClure looked, he wasn't sure if the man was real or an apparition. "In God's name, speak! Who are you?" To which the figure stood up and said, "I am Lieutenant Bedford Pym, late of HMS Resolute, and I've come, sir, to rescue you." Pym, attached to the Arctic squadron of Captain Sir Edward Belcher, had indeed come ahead of his companions to rescue McClure. Sledging to Winter Harbor, Perry's old spot, they had found a note left there by McClure's men and Investigator the year before. Knowing of McClure's plight, knowing that Investigator was stuck, Pym had assembled men back at Winter Harbor and crossed the ice for over 100 miles to reach Investigator and to bring McClure and his men across the ice there to waiting British sailors who would then sledge them back to Resolute and then to home. They did so, and McClure would audaciously claim when he returned home to England that he, indeed, was the conqueror of the Northwest Passage because he'd navigated it all the way through. Lady Franklin, among others, was not amused when Parliament actually gave him the title of discoverer of the Northwest Passage and a medal and a big monetary prize, pointing out that he'd been carried part of the way in other people's sledges across the ice after abandoning his ship, and indeed had then made his way back home in yet another person's vessel. It didn't help matters that the same expedition that had rescued McClure also came to its own bad end, not in terms of a great loss of life, but loss of the ships. After being stuck in the ice for a period of time, Belcher decided to return home, and so he abandoned the majority of his fleet in the ice, figuring they would never make it out. The Admiralty was furious. Belcher was court-martialed, but got off on a technicality. He had been ordered to come home with all expedience. And so he was forgiven, but never given a command again. It didn't help, by the way, poor Edward Belcher, when the following year an American whaling ship spotted one of his vessels, Resolute, bobbing in the ice pack off the coast of Greenland, having drifted under her own command out of the Arctic in the ice, to be found and rescued by the Yankees with glasses of wine still set on the table, hands of cards still laid out exactly as they were, everything in perfect order, though covered with mold. The ship was restored, put back into service by the Congress of the United States as a gift to Great Britain, returned to Queen Victoria in 1854. The vessel might have gone out again, but the Admiralty was done with looking for Franklin. He was obviously dead, as were his men. The Crimean War was raging, and so HMS Resolute was retired. She ultimately would be broken up, by the way, and the timbers from her were used by the Queen to make three desks, one for the American whaling captain who had rescued Resolute, one for Lady Franklin, and the third, a very large, magnificent desk carved with Arctic scenes, was delivered to the White House as a present to the President of the United States, Rutherford B. Hayes. After passing through various rooms in the White House, being stowed in an attic, it was rescued by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy and installed in the Oval Office, where it remains to this day as the desk of the President of the United States. Lady Franklin, not wanting to give up, finally hired this veteran Arctic explorer, Francis Leopold McClintock, in 1857 to go out and find some trace of her husband, to recover news of his fate and his companions and any records of their precious expedition, records in particular that would prove that they had discovered the Northwest Passage. McClintock and the steamer Fox pushed north, froze in. His engineers died, and so he had to dismantle the steam machinery by himself. By sledge, he and others pushed south to the area of King William Island, and there they discovered what an earlier explorer had hinted at. John Ray of the Hudson's Bay Company in 1854 had reported the Inuit told him of ships caught in the ice, of men trapped and trying to march free, of men dying, and men reduced in those times to the ultimate expedient of eating one another. Lady Franklin didn't like that news either, nor did the rest of England. Englishmen do not eat one another. And so Dr. Ray's reports were ignored. Now, on King William Island, McClintock and Lieutenant William Hobson discovered the evidence. They found skeletons. One young man face down on an Arctic berm, the wind plucking at the blue melton cloth of his uniform that still stuck to his bones. In his breast pocket, a notebook. He was Harry Pegler, captain of the foretop of HMS Terror. The last note in his journal, scribbled in pencil as he died and tucked it back in his pocket. O death, where is thy sting? In a cairn on the shores of the island, they found a note, the only note ever left to be found by the Franklin expedition, a standard Admiralty form. It has two separate notations. The first, in 1847, talks about a successful transit of the ship making her way in, wintering, and men and sledge patrols moving south beyond a certain point. They had actually reached a spot of land that previous explorers had seen. In short, they knew a way through the Northwest Passage, but the ice had blocked them in and locked them inexorably in its grip. Franklin had died in June of 1847, presumably of old age. Others had died as well. And then, April 25th, 1848, the final note. The ships having been trapped, immovable, men dying, the two surviving commanders, Francis Rodden Moira Crozier, to the top, James Fitzjames, had decided to land their men and their supplies and to march south for Back's Great Fish River, where great numbers of game were known to exist, where the men could hunt, replenish themselves, and then march south to the Hudson's Bay. This is the landscape they marched over. This is where they died. We know today that the effects of hypothermia, perhaps lead poisoning from the tinned provisions they carried, all played a role. As well, consider this. These Englishmen, so convinced were they of their technological prowess with their huge, massive steam-powered ships, their modern library of 2,000 books, the Daguerrean apparatus, all of the scientific instruments to map and to quantify and measure the Arctic, had gone forth in their standard issue Royal Navy uniforms of thick blue wool and leather boots. What a way to die. Up there, marching over this terrain in the heat, you begin to sweat. It wicks into that wool, and then it begins to freeze. The leather in your boots is torn and shredded by these rocks. Gradually, you begin to numb. Gradually, that wool, soaked, begins to build with ice, and it becomes your shroud. 129 men, every last one of them gone. Nothing left but traces. On the shores, they found a boat being hauled by other men. In it, the skeletons of men who had died there. One man with a rifle still across his lap, guarding his fellows from the approach of either the Inuit or the polar bears. And other more grim traces, bones indicating that men had either slaughtered each other or had eaten their dead comrades. The legacy of the Franklin expedition was a legacy of disaster. But it also was one which tremendously inspired the English. There's nothing better than dying heroically as a failure. And for John Franklin, in particular, having a widow like Jane, who continued to push just as much as she had when she considered him alive, now for a place for John in history, well, it couldn't be any better. Franklin and his men became enshrined as lost heroic explorers. Franklin himself not only had a huge statue erected in his home in Spilsby, but also in Tasmania, now a hero, the once disgraced Lieutenant Governor, was an object of pride, and in London as well. And then finally enshrined in Westminster Abbey, where Jane's nephew, Alfred Lord Tennyson, would write the epitaph. Not here, the white north hath thy bones, and thou, heroic sailor soul, journey now toward no earthly pole. John Richardson, one of Franklin's companions, penned the other great epitaph for Franklin and his men. That epitaph is the title of this painting, which hangs today in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. They forged the last link with their lives. Inspirational kind of stuff, thrilling sorts of things that fired the souls of every possible explorer and want-to-be explorer, including this young man growing up on the shores of Oslo Fjord in Norway, Roald Grevling Amundsen. Amundsen, growing up, wanted to be an explorer. His parents wanted him to be a doctor, but he wanted to be an explorer. He told later that as he read of Franklin's exploits, he decided that I, too, wanted to suffer for a cause, if not on the way in the burning deserts to Jerusalem, then freezing in the frozen north. To inure himself to the hardships of the north, he used to take his windows in the middle of the night and open them up, exposing them to the fury of a Norwegian winter, strip himself naked, pull his bed covers back, and lie there shivering until he fell asleep. His mother would wake up about 2 or 3 in the morning, the house would be cold, she'd go in and find little Roald asleep, blue and shivering, cover him back up, close the windows. About an hour or so later, he would wake up warm and toasty, throw everything off, throw the windows open again. You get some idea of the perseverance of this young man. Apprenticing himself to Fridtjof Nansen, one of Norway's great explorers, Amundsen decided he would go into the north with Nansen and his ship Fram, which had tried to drift to the North Pole, locked into the polar ice caps. Amundsen, coming out of Nansen's extended exploration family, decided, though, that what he really needed to do, once Nansen's expeditions had ended, not necessarily in success. Fram had never made it to the North Pole. The ice does not move as easily as one would hope. Fram had been pushed back, drifting. Nansen had had to sledge home and nearly had been lost. Proclaimed for dead, he also had been resurrected, stepping out alive from the Arctic, and had become internationally famous. Amundsen wanted this, and so he decided that what he should do, if he couldn't drift to the North Pole, if he couldn't get to the North Pole, and there were others pushing for it, then perhaps what he would do is he would pick up where Franklin had left off. He would be the first, not to discover the Northwest Passage, but to be the first to sail through it. He was a good student of history, and so as he studied the accounts of the earlier expeditions, he learned a few things. One of the first, as you can see from the picture, is dress like the locals. He learned the style of life in the north. He learned how to eat the food that no civilized Englishman would eat. And believe me, having gone to the north with the Inuit and having sampled the delicacy of freshly killed raw seal, I can assure you it is an acquired taste. But it's what's necessary. A better supply of energy and vitamin C you won't find up there. He also determined that he would use a small ship. He purchased the tiny little 70-ton-year-old fishing smack Yaw, named for the wife of the fisherman who had built it, and decided to fit her out with a tiny little diesel engine to go through the passage. Huge ships like Erebus and Terror were not necessary. A tiny vessel was all that you needed, because indeed, so much of those waterways were shallow. There were sand shoals. To get through, he would have to follow a path that some of the explorers had suggested, down around King William Island, where Franklin and his men had marched and died, and then through a narrow little spot, make his way past Victoria Island. Yoa is very small. Today, she is preserved at the the Norske Sjøfartsmuseum or National Maritime Museum of Norway on the shores of the Bogdøy Peninsula in Oslo. And as you can see, very crowded, particularly when you take a small group of men, pack them into her, and set out. She was so small that they couldn't even bring all of their own provisions and supplies. Supply ships carried the rest of them to the shores of Canada, where Amundsen would load them, and then slowly, carefully, with his ship packed to the gunwales with these tins of supplies, he would make his way through the passage. He had to do it in 2.5 years or run out of food, but he also knew that he could stretch it a bit if he augmented his supplies by hunting. With his men, Amundsen got ready to go, but ran afoul of his creditors because, like so many other explorers, he needed sponsorship. When he finally left Oslo Harbor, he had to sneak out in the middle of the night to avoid arrest by the sheriff because his creditors had seized the ship. When they made their way across the Atlantic and into the Northwest Passage, after loading more supplies in Labrador, they made their way to Beachy Island, where Franklin had wintered the first year. "He felt now as if he was in hallowed ground," said Amundsen. "At last, the scenes that had thrilled him as a child lay before him. He knew which way to turn now. He would turn south from Beachy Island, down through the sounds, past King William Island. He would make his way, and indeed did, to a spot where no one else had gone before in any ship. He reached a spot that John and James Ross had marched to with their Inuit helpers in the 1830s, but no vessel had ever been there. Yoa only made it because she had bumped and ground her way over a shoal. He had to throw over tons of supplies to get the ship off. She nearly was lost. Another time the engine caught fire and nearly engulfed the ship. It was not an easy trip. These are not voyages for the faint of heart. But they did so. They made their way into a tiny little cove, which he named Yoa's Harbor, or Yoa's Haven, Johaven, or today's Johaven, on King William Island. There, the Norwegians settled down, celebrated Christmas, but also interacted with the local Netsilik Inuit, who told them tales of the Rosses, passed on by their grandfathers. And Amundsen set out not only to chart and map, but also to go and reestablish the location of the magnetic North Pole. Amundsen was also able to do so, and his readings became the first to demonstrate that the magnetic North Pole does migrate and move. And of course, today, that magnetic North Pole is nowhere near King William Island. It's further up towards Resolute. Amundsen also took on board a young Inuit boy as an apprentice to take with him through the Northwest Passage. When the ice finally cleared and Yoa was unlocked from Johaven, they headed out. And in 1905, in August of 1905, they made it to King Point in Alaska. They had actually gone through the Northwest Passage. They had reached a spot where American whalers visited frequently, and in fact, as they sailed up to that point, they saw in the distance the American whaling ship Charles Hansen out of San Francisco. Amundsen looked, and for a moment, the stoic Norwegian cracked, dropped, and wept. Unfortunately, winter was setting in, and the ice trapped Yaw there at King Point. Savvy, understanding that his creditors and his detractors were out there, and also that rumors of his demise were beginning to circulate, Amundsen decided to leave the rest of the men in Yaw and to take a dog sled several hundred miles to Nome, the end of the line for the telegraph station, to send the world the news that he had conquered the Northwest Passage. Always a promoter, ever mindful of publicity, Roald Amundsen became world famous. And indeed, what a story it is, not only to have navigated the passage, but then practically, you know, on his own, having trudged over 1,000 miles back and forth to send news to the world. So, in that year of 1905, Amundsen had achieved what men had sought for 3 centuries. Someone had at last sailed through the Northwest Passage. It had been conquered. Amundsen and Yoa, once he returned to her, would sail out into the Pacific, and he would beach his ship in San Francisco in 1906 to become a shrine to his epic achievement. He would go on now, alt for Norge, everything for Norway, to seek other prizes. He wanted the North Pole, but in 1909, American Robert Perry supposedly reached it first. Amundsen decided then to turn his sights to the south. Fitting out Fram, he sailed out, and in 1911, in a race, which some British thought as unseemly, beat Briton Robert Falcon Scott to the South Pole. With his conquest of the South Pole, Amundsen's fame was certainly secured, if not a bit of notoriety. It's still not entirely cricket to talk about Old Roald in the Royal Geographical Society in London, at least in some quarters. With this, he decided he would make one last push. He doubted Parry had made it to the North Pole, and indeed, just as much as the Northwest Passage had been the Arctic Grail, to cite Pierre Burton, so too had been the North Pole. He would revive Nansen's old idea of sailing north, trapping his ship in the ice and drifting with it. Fram was too old and worn out, and so he turned to builder Christian Jensen in Asker, Norway, again on the shores of Oslofjord, and asked him to build a ship that would be staunch and solid. Her name, when constructed in 1917, was Maud, named for the Queen of Norway, shaped like an egg so the ice would not crack her, a smaller copy of Fram. Maud, when launched, was placed into the grip of the ocean when Amundsen seized a huge block of ice and said, "Til isen du bygget, for the ice you are made. In the ice you will spend your life, in the ice you will work." She slid in, launched, readied. Unfortunately, World War I was raging, and while Norway was not in the combat zone, the ship would have to sail across the Atlantic past German U-boats. So instead of sailing south through the Panama Canal and in through Bering Strait, Amundsen decided to go across the top of the world through the Northeast Passage, across the top of Norway, Russia, and Siberia. For the next expedition, again, a small group of men, including Oscar Wisting, who had joined him on the trip to the South Pole, outfitted this larger, more expansive vessel. What a difference a few years international fame and sponsorship can make. Maud set out, wonderfully appointed, able to be frozen in. Amundsen had learned his lessons well. She went and then was caught in the ice off the coast of Siberia for the next 2 years. They couldn't reach the North Pole. They tried, but it was a difficult time. Patience began to wear thin. One of the ship's scientists decided to trek out on his own. Two men also decided to leave and were never seen again. Amundsen himself was nearly killed when the pet polar bear that he was raising turned and mauled him. And again, when taking scientific instruments in his tent, he was overcome with carbon monoxide fumes and nearly killed. But for all of this, Maud also saw a new phase of polar exploration, more science as opposed to geographic striving, an opportunity to learn, to study. Here's Amundsen in the great cabin of Maud, but also a chance to treat and work with the local people, particularly the Chukchi people of Siberia, who were studied by Dr. Harald Ulrich Sverdrup, who was one of the scientists on the expedition. Amundsen, of course, for all of this science, still needed his epic achievement. Maud retreated out of the Arctic in 1920, refitted, tried to go back, but was pushed again by the ice and damaged. In 1922, she sailed again under the command of Wisting, rolled Queen up, stood on the deck and gave a speech, surrounded by the U.S. Coast Guard in Alaska in that year of 1922, and announced he wasn't sailing this time. While she would go north, he would fly. His seaplane crashed on takeoff, though, and was unable to complete the journey. So too, poor Maud. Pushed back again, finally in 1925, in the last final attempt under Oscar Wisting, she retreated, this time swallowed not by the ice, but by mounting bills and debt. And again, Amundsen's creditors stepped in, seized the ship in Seattle, and sold her at auction. The buyers, the Hudson's Bay Company, who took her to Vancouver, British Columbia, refitted her and named her Bay Maud, and sent her north as a floating warehouse and wireless station. And there, in the winter of 1931, in Cambridge Bay on Victoria Island, she sank, conveniently, perhaps, too big to navigate the Northwest Passage. She had grounded on shoals when trying to be beached. Now she sank, swallowed, and gradually disintegrated, disappearing for the most part, beneath the waters of Cambridge Bay. At this time, Amundsen himself was also gone. He died not too long before. One of his great competitors, Umberto Nobile, had launched a huge dirigible to try to fly to the pole, just as Amundsen had done earlier, and dropped flags. Nobile's dirigible crashed and disappeared. Amundsen decided to mount a rescue expedition. He took off from Tromsø, Norway, in a small float plane and was never seen again. Only a fuel tank, supposedly from the plane, washed ashore in Norway. All that was left, the only reminder of perhaps what had happened. What a way to go. Today, Maud, or Bay Maud, still sits there on the shores of Cambridge Bay, her broken hulk surrounded by ice in the winter, lapped by the still frigid -2.5-degree waters in summer, still moored in place, her masts fallen but her rigging tangled along the side, her hull seemingly staunch but filled with the broken beams that once supported her against the pressure of the ice as she tried for the North Pole. Still, compartments and spaces open to the frozen water with things perfectly preserved, including bundles of furs the Hudson's Bay Company never had a chance to ship out of the North. Ironically enough, when she was hired as Bay Maud and was modified, the naval architect in Vancouver who did so, Tom Halliday, drew her lines down, copied them, and then used them a few months later to design a new ship for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that was to be sent to the North as their very first vessel in the Arctic. Launched in 1928, that vessel, RCMP St. Rock, commanded by another son of Norway, a distant relative of Amundsen's, Henry Asbjørn Larsen, would become the second ship to make it through the Northwest Passage during the years 1940 and 1942. And today is enshrined ashore as the centerpiece of the Vancouver Maritime Museum. As for Amundsen, again, nobody knows exactly what happened. His plane obviously went down, whether in the water or locked into the ice. Roald Amundsen, like John Franklin, became the nucleus, perhaps, of an iceberg. And if you look at what appropriate epitaph you could write for this man, it perhaps would not be that of Franklin, some lofty statement of searching for no earthly pole. Rather this: Roald Amundsen electrified not only his native Norway in 1905, when he made it through the Northwest Passage, he electrified the world. He was a reminder and an inspiration in that magic year that the spirit of exploration was not something of distant times. It was not some aspect of the 18th or the 19th century that had been swept aside as the new technology was moving to the forefront. It was a reminder that the spirit of exploration at its best is a constant challenging of your own personal limitations, the limitations that the world places at any given time or any given place, not just on people, but places and on nations themselves. Exploration is the means by which we better ourselves, by reaching out not only to geographic landmarks and to places never yet achieved, but new avenues of technological expression, of learning to delve not only out there, but in here. Indeed, when you look at somebody like Roald Amundsen, John Franklin, all the Arctic explorers, perhaps this can be said. Of all that they mapped, perhaps what they mapped the best and explained to all of us was not the map of up there, but the map of the human heart and the human psyche. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. We have time for a few questions from the audience. If you'd like to raise your hand, we'll bring you a microphone. Just wait for the microphone to arrive. Question over here, please.
I'd like to know where Dr. Cook stands. in relationship with Peary? Did he get any nearer to the North Pole?
The famous Dr. Cook, one of Peary's great detractors. These two guys sparred back and forth, and they were colleagues at the same time. Dr. Cook gets a lot of bad press. He was proclaimed a liar. Peary spent a lot of time savaging his reputation. But then what do you expect of an American admiral who marches into the heart of Greenland and steals a meteorite that is the sacred icon for the Greenlanders who have revered it since it fell from the sky? Peary, I think, is a bit of a snake. I should probably be careful about this. Cook, most likely also. I don't think either of them made it. And of course, National Geographic, my employers, have gone out and staked their name saying that Peary made it. I don't think so. The way the ice moves, neither Cook nor Peary, I think, could have adequately done it. Observations notwithstanding, and yeah, they did it this way. The way the ice is moving, you can't walk fast enough. You have to get there by icebreaker these days, or in the case of Amundsen and the others, you fly there. Who do I think the first person was to reach the North Pole? I think it's Roald Amundsen and Lincoln Ellsworth in their dirigible Norge. I think they did it.
Other questions?
First of all, thank you very much for this amazing lecture. And then my question is, you mentioned that in 1818, when John Ross made the expedition, it was a short-term global warming. Can you comment if we are now indeed in the middle of a global warming period? Or I heard on news that the oceans have a cycle of warming and cooling and things like that, and if this is true. Thanks.
Well, being shy and unwilling to venture an opinion, but again, with a caveat, I'm not a scientist who studies that. I'm an archaeologist. What I have learned from talking to colleagues, and opinion is divided, is that there are cycles, particularly up there. Ice retreats, ice comes back, and there have been periods of warming and then freezing in the poles. Certainly, during the Thule culture, before the Inuit were there, the Arctic was far more temperate, and people lived in skin tents in areas now where you just could not. All of that being said, I think it is rather clear that there is a fair amount more warming going on now than we've previously seen. Ice levels have retreated dramatically in a way that has not been seen for some time, in terms of maybe thousands of years, maybe even longer. The result is, of course, that there's an ecosystem risk up there. There are other resources that are also now coming into a stage of risk, not the least of which is Canadian sovereignty, because the age-old dream of the Northwest Passage is about to become true, not for the riches of Cathay, mind you, but for a cheaper, more expedient way to get from the Atlantic to the Pacific without having to go around Cape Horn or through the expensive toll-collecting Panama Canal, or for larger post-Panamax vessels, the small, constricted Panama Canal. And with large numbers of ships going through what Canada argues is an internal waterway, but without the opportunity to police some of those vessels for oil spills or other impacts, a warm Northwest Passage that's even easily navigable can be a problem, particularly since the government has, for the most part, sat on its hands over the last few years and not exerted any form of Canadian sovereignty until the Danes got all fussy about a small island not too long ago. So there are some issues there. There is global warming. The cause of that global warming is controversial. It's debated. People have their strong opinions. And I, unfortunately, don't possess the requisite scientific knowledge to be able to weigh intelligently on that debate, other than to say, yeah, it's warm. And we actually, in one expedition, were able to water ski through the Bering Strait, the things we explorers do.
Question over here. Wait for the microphone, please.
Uh, What kind of forces are happening on the hull of a boat when it becomes icebound, and what happens to the boat?
The type of forces that happen when a vessel is icebound, well, the common concept is that a ship gets frozen in and the ice is stationary and doesn't move, and you're just stuck. What happens, of course, is that the ice constantly moves. You have a pack of ice, but then you've got sea, you've got the sea itself, you've got wave action, you've got tidal rise and fall. So the ice will fluctuate and move. That movement will be transmitted through the ice over long distances. Ice will begin to bulge and break and hummock up. You saw the illustration where the guy's pulling their sledge over those large pressure ridges, those mountains. As that happens, the ice continues to mound and push. It's just constantly in motion. Henry Larson, captain of the St. Roch, said he often felt that the ice was a living thing, that he constantly had to contend against and to fight in order to assure his ship's survival. The only way it really works for you is to come closer into shore and be frozen in solid, so you have no water between your keel and the bottom. You're just locked in ice. But if you're in pack ice, it's the worst possible thing. So you have squeezing pressures, in particular, that can nip and catch you. Vessels in the past would be squeezed, and nipping is the term they'd use, where two sheets of ice would come in and just start crushing your hull, or it would start to push you under, you'd start to capsize and just be swamped, which is certainly what we saw happen with Antarctic voyages and in the Arctic as well. Fram, Mold, and St. Roch were all built with an egg-shaped hull. That simple shape, of course, as you know, you ever try to break an egg just by squeezing it? You have to really exert some pressure. You have to crack it on the edge to get it to go. They figured that out. So when the ice nips and pushes, a vessel like that just simply gets lifted up out of the ice and rocks back and forth. In 1937, St. Roch and the Hudson's Bay Company ship Fort James were side by side and raced straight. The ice came in. Fort James was crushed and went down. St. Roch pushed out and was rocking back and forth on her keel on the ice floe as they rescued the crew of Fort James. So those forces are very much at work as well. Sometimes the ice can just move along rapidly and push you right up onto a beach, which is what happened to Fury. It nearly happened to St. Roch once as well. In that case, what Larson had to do is he took his anchor chains, dropped them, couldn't get them through the ice, so he took his huge iron hawse, ran it out onto a nearby rock, wrapped it around, and as the ice came by, he actually was able to winch St. Roch up out of the ice and slide across it as the ice slid underneath him and went onto the beach. They don't make them like that anymore, either ships or guys.
One last question. Over here.
You talked about an empty spot in the map that they were pushing for to complete, and Amundsen had sailed through it. In your knowledge and experience, who was the first to actually complete the map or to walk through the Northwest Passage or to see the Northwest Passage?
Some unnamed Inuit a long time ago. A lot of those spots had actually been mapped out. Some of those maps that Ross had drawn for him and Perry had maps drawn as well showed the terrain pretty easily. But of course, do you trust the word of a savage? Do you trust the word of some uneducated person? No, I mean, it's all, education is relative. The British condescendingly, for the most part, ignored Inuit advice, and in Franklin's case, they all died. Amundsen, like McClintock, adopted some of those methods and lived. As to who really mapped and made it through, other than the Inuit, I think it's like everything in this life. No one person does anything alone. In this case, the team that did it was probably Peter Dees and his companions, Simpson. It's Dr. John Ray. It's James Clark Ross and his Inuit guides. And it's some of Franklin's guys. They all pretty much figured out the map. And that last bit really is that area from King William Island heading over into Coronation and right there by Cambridge Bay. That last spot, they mapped it out. Roald Amundsen studied everybody else's failures and made it through. But again, some would say by the skin of his teeth. He nearly lost jaw on that north end of King William Island when they grounded on that shoal and were nearly wrecked. And it was only by throwing away a lot of his food that he was able to get through. And then, thank God for the Netsilik, who helped him through the winter. So, therein too is the lesson. Thank God for the Netsilik. You only get through this life on the forbearance, the sympathy, the help, and the support of others. And everybody, with no matter what achievement they make, no matter how great they may make themselves sound or seem as an explorer, as a scientist, stands on the shoulders of others. Thank you.
Thank you again, Jim, for a very stimulating lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Jim Delgado will be back this afternoon with Howard Burton, Robert Friedel, Mike Lazaridis, 4 o'clock in the Black Hole Bistro for Bistro Banter. You're welcome to join us for that. The exit is from the top on your left, my right. Thanks very much.